Welcome to the Future of Work podcast, brought to you by Mana. We're on a mission to help you prepare for, embrace, and navigate the inevitable changes happening in the world of work. We'll be deep diving into thought-provoking conversations with industry leaders, experts, and visionaries. We'll explore how artificial intelligence, automation, and other cutting-edge technologies such as the blockchain are revolutionizing the way we work, learn, and live. So, if you're curious about the future, passionate about innovation, and eager to learn, let us help you redefine success in a world where the only constant is change. Let's build the future of work together. Welcome onto the Future of Work, Tony.
Hi, Tony.
Hello, team. Thank you for having me.
Really excited to be here with you. Tony is the founder and CEO with Oyster. We have Antonietta, who is co-hosting this series where Searching for Mana is going to be looking all around and deeply into the ever more fascinating topic of future of work. So good to have you on the show with us, Anto.
Thank you, Lloyd. Very excited to be here.
Likewise. To get straight into it, Tony, if you could be so kind, for anyone in the audience who wants some more context or perhaps hasn't come across Oyster just yet, to explain the mission statement of Oyster, please.
Absolutely. So Oyster, we are here to empower businesses all over the world to tap into the global talent pool. We do that so that we transition the world into a more equal and free world of work. We have built a global employment infrastructure where we take care of the payroll, the benefits, the compliance, so that when a company is trying to hire somebody on the other side of the world, it doesn't feel more difficult than hiring them locally. We want to remove all the barriers in front of companies to tap into the global talent pool. And we believe, and I can give you some data, that that will have a significant impact on the world, inequality, reversing brain drain, and wealth distribution.
And the first question, and feel free to answer these as quick fire, or if something really grabs you as long form as you'd like, Tony, okay. Was there a pivotal moment in your life that shaped you to become the leader you are known to be and to draw your interests toward the future of work?
I was walking with my co-founder today in San Francisco, and he asked me the question, what are the conditions for you to go back to work? Because I don't need to go back to work. I want to go back to work. And I told him the conditions are, I want to be free to live where I want to live. I want to have the freedom of location. Now I live in the beautiful island of Cyprus on the beach. I want to be close to my children. I don't want to sacrifice my connection with my children because of work. And I want to be surrounded with massive amount of diversity. And it turned out that these needs were not only my needs, they were universal human needs, a need for freedom, a need for being close to your loved ones. And this was a pivotal moment. This is where I decided that I wanted to build Oyster because I want work to work for me, and I want to make work for people as well.
Thank you, Tony. Another one for you. What do you think is the biggest challenge or challenges that the future of work will face in the next 3 years, and how do you believe they will be solved?
I think the biggest challenge in accelerating the future of work is the reticence of leaders to trust employees around the world. So we leaders, when we used to work in the office, we were programmed to correlate output with presence. We would see people in seat and we would assume that they are trustworthy. We can trust them to do their work. When that disappeared during the pandemic, we moved to remote work. There was a lot of experiment in that. Many leaders were not able to adapt to this new world of work. And therefore, they started to mistrust their employees when they did not see them working. And they started to control, to micromanage. The employees felt that, and it became a vicious circle of mistrust and low productivity, mistrust and low productivity. And therefore, there is now this this one step backward. Some leaders are asking their employees to go back to the office because of that issue. So it's really the core, the biggest challenge is about how do you enable leaders to create more trust-based organizations, and how can you trust your team to do their best no matter where they are and no matter when they work. So this is the biggest challenge I see in moving us to a better future of work.
Love it. Anto, back at you, you do the next one as well. I think this is your question.
When innovating, we realize no one's perfect, and sometimes there is a bit of a process of trial and error. So if you can think of an example of a time where you were trying to implement a new process or maybe an application, a tool internal to improve a system or to impact the company culture, and you believe that either you failed or you could have done better, if you can give us an example of that and how you would do it differently today.
Yeah. Look, this process of building business, especially startup, is a process of working by iteration. You have to accept that you're never going to be perfect, and it's a path to continuous improvement. So example for me is when I build teams. So I know that it's going to be an iterative process to put together the various teams in the organization, put the right people in the right places, and you iterate on that, right? So you iterate on that, and you in every iteration you improve the team dynamic, the team culture, the team ability to collaborate cross-functionally. Now, how did I improve that between my first startup and my second startup? Was that in my first startup I wasn't very scientifically accurate when it comes to talent acquisition. And now in Oyster, every one of my leaders, and it's around 15 people in the company, you know, think about the VP and above, they all been hired through a very accurate executive search process where we looked at the fit for the job, the mission alignment. We looked at the diversity we want to bring in the team. And that has enabled me to reduce the number of iterations I need to do on building teams, yet you still have to iterate.
Amazing. We'll cover that in some of the tooling questions later in the interview. Fascinated to know what you might be using in that process from an analytical perspective, but we'll come back to that just to carry on with the last few questions in this round. What is the, and as an avid investor as well, what is the trends, particularly in the future of work, that you're really either investing into and excited about, Tony?
Yeah, so I invest in the intersection of software and impact. So I look at opportunities in the future of work, HR technology, of companies that innovate on that. So think about a platform that increases the level of engagement in a market, right? In a business. Or a platform that enables a fairer compensation around the world for remote worker, or a platform that enables the availability of great benefits of people no matter where they are. So all of this distribution of great employee experience that drives better outcome for people and deliver impact for the world is where I focus most of my investment in the sector.
Thank you. And now another one for me. If you were to sum it up in a short sentence, what is the future of work to you?
The future of work is a future where there is freedom of location, freedom of when to work. It's a flexible future of work, and is a future where the human is at the center of it. It's a human-centric world of work that protects people from the unnecessary stresses of work and enable them to be successful, no matter who they are and no matter where they come from.
Thank you.
Thanks, Tony. Love it. Moving on to, for a while, rift around the topic of remote work, which I think is one of the core elements that we wanted to discuss with you. Just to start off with a recent statement. The remote work experiment was a failure, is a recent quote from Sam Altman from Y Combinator fame and OpenAI leader. And he is giving reference to a lot of big tech, and now certainly, to quote them, BlackRock, big financial organizations, bringing their employees back into the office. So there has been an era of remote work in some of the largest companies in the world, and certainly the startup scene. And then there's been a hybrid solution. And, you know, I have a peer group who are in, you know, VP and above, in some instances, roles in your large big tech or large financial organizations or wherever it might be, who'd moved to, you know, the sticks and had a different way of life and was still being able to do really well in their roles. And a lot of those people are coming back to the city now because they're being told they have to be in the office 4-5 days a week. And it's really, I would say over the last 6 months, we're in the middle of 2023, dramatically started to swing back in that direction. I'd love you to talk around specifically what your view is of the statement that Sam has come out with, where he's saying that experiment is over.
Quoting the financial institutions, I doubt they are a role model for the modern organization. Many people I know work in the financial institution. The only reason they work there is because of the pay is so good. Everything else sucks. So it's really hard to use the financial industry as especially the old, bigger banks and bigger financial institution as a role model of the future of work organization, right? I'm not surprised that they are the first to push people to go back to the office, because again, it's a leadership crisis. Are these leaders focused on the well-being of their teams and their people, how high they put that in their organization, or they're focused on the quarterly results to deliver the number for the shareholders and at all costs, right? That's the question. And so when you asked me to comment on this quote, remote work experiment was a failure. A failure for whom? So is it failure for leaders of these older generation type of organization? Yeah, probably yes. But it's a win for everybody else. It's a win for the people, because people gain level of flexibility and freedom they never get by being locked in and being forced to live in a place where they don't want to live and work at hours where they don't want to work. Is it a failure for businesses? No. Today, businesses, by tapping into a global talent pool and enabling people to be successful no matter what they are, they expand their access to talent. They create level of diversity that is unheard of. And they deliver a higher level of engagement. At Oyster, we have one of the highest level of engagements in our peer group. Although we are distributed in 80 countries, we have 50% women in the business, including on the leadership team, very intentionally building a massively diverse organization. It's also a win for the planet. We all know the benefit of not needing to commute to the office and reducing your environmental footprint, but there is a much bigger trend here at play, which is the distribution of people on this planet. I mean, we are pouring 4 times the equivalent of New York City in concrete to build urban areas every year on this planet. And we all know this is not sustainable. By distributing people more evenly on this planet, while we reduce our collective impact on the planet and move into a more sustainable future. So yeah, it might be a failure for few leaders on the top that are not able to adapt to this new world, but it's a win for everybody else.
One point that I find intriguing is if this model, you know, a different organization, as you said, will have different models and something that works for them or that doesn't, what is your view on the impact that this model will have on larger corporations versus SMEs? How quickly do you believe that the two type of organizations can adapt to this model of work? Do you think there is one that is more reactive versus the other that is more proactive? One is destined to fail versus the other? I don't know. What is your view around this? If it has an impact at all?
It has a major impact, Antonietta. And the impact is that the best organization of tomorrow are going to be the organization who are attractive to the best talent in the world. And the best talent in the world knows now that they can work remotely effectively, no matter what they are. So they're not going to let go this new degree of freedom that just gained. So the best talent in the world is going to gravitate around companies that make them successful, no matter what they are. And that requires being intentional in how you create your culture, in how you build trust, in how you set up the tools, and how you work together, that larger organizations are going to have difficulty to adapt to. They cannot move as fast as more agile, small organizations. So I do see a shift that the best talent is going to migrate from larger organizations that are more rigid in their workforce management, and they are more slower in adopting a future of work. They're gonna shift to companies that give them that opportunity to be successful no matter what they are. Like if you're a top talent, you want to go work in Spain, right? You live in Barcelona, right? You know, it's probably a great place to live, right? Compared to living in central London and paying three times more rent. So you're there maybe for a lifestyle reason, and you're a top talent. Would you work for a company that forces you to go back to office in London, even if the pay is 10% more, or you would work for a company that makes you successful living in Barcelona? Well, you're going to pick the latter. So we're going to see, talent makes businesses successful or not, right? So the best talent is going to gravitate for companies that are seriously adopting remote work and full distribution and hybrid work in order to make people successful.
So I agree. What I gather from your last consideration is that in a way you are implying that those companies who adapt to this new model of business will create a virtuous cycle where they will attract people with the same values and the same type of culture. And so that will become the winning culture in the end of this process. Is this what you're saying?
That's what I'm saying. And try to explain in 2023 to the top talent that you have to force them to commute. That makes no sense. It has no impact on their productivity. They're going to go to work and they're going to end up in office doing meetings that they can do on Zoom, right? So it is really difficult for leaders to explain why people, they have no tangible evidence, no scientific proof that working in the office is better than working remotely. Obviously, the answer is that it depends, right? So if you have, it depends on the task you're doing, it depends on the industry you're in, and there's so many factors. But the 95% of knowledge work can be done remotely effectively and at scale. And there's always exception, but the exceptions are a small piece of the overall work that needs to be done.
So Tony, thank you for giving us your view on the remote working model being adaptable to basically, based on what you said, mostly every company in the world, with a few exceptions, but you know, maybe we can go back into it a bit later. But now what we would like to cover is the how do you build that winning culture that we just mentioned, the one attracting the best talent. So with a remote team, it goes without saying that the asynchronous model of communication seems to be the winning one. What is your view about that? And what are the benefits, and is there anything that both workers and the leaders should be aware of in terms of pitfalls, if any?
Sure. Let me talk about the how. And the how is there's four areas, in my opinion, that are important for leaders to intentionally be focused on to build the how. So first is, as you mentioned, is it, we call them the tools and the rules. How do you communicate and collaborate? And it's really about defaulting to asynchronous way of communication and collaboration, which is very adapted to knowledge work. If you're a knowledge worker, this is the most efficient and highly productive way of collaboration and communication, assuming that we all in the company work in the same way. That's critical, right? So it's critical to define intentionally, how do you collaborate and communicate? What tools do you use for what? And train people on this and model the way as leaders. So in our case at Oyster, we have an extensive explanation about when do you use Slack for what, how do you use Notion for what is Zoom for, what is Loom for, and then we train people on best practices of remote work. How do we work here? Okay, and it becomes part of your culture. The culture is not anymore these water cooler conversation that you have little or no control of. The culture becomes how do you work together, these norms of collaboration, okay? That's number one. Number two in the how, the intentional how, is to have clear goals and expectation in the business, because now that you don't see people working and you're not able to use your old way of thinking about performance, which is presence equal performance, right? That we inherited from the Industrial Revolution, by the way, because you need to go to the plant, to the factory, and then the more you're in the factory, the more widgets you produced. Okay, that was inherited from that era. Now with knowledge work, you need to really define clearly what are the goals and the expectation from each people, and you want to connect that with the team goals and the company goals. At Oyster, we use a tool called Objective Key Results, or OKR. It's a widely used tool within agile organizations to set goals and expectation that connects the individual goal with the team goal with the company goal. We probably have the OKR process of a company three times of our size in terms of maturity. So we've intentionally over-invested in that area of the business to make sure no matter where you are, you know what is expected from you and what success looks like. And since you have the tools and the rules, you know how to collaborate no matter where you are. Number three is about being intentional in building trust. So we talked earlier that there is a trust issue that is a challenge between leaders and employees when they don't see them in the office. In the case of distributed work, you have to focus on building high trusting teams. And, what does it mean? Every organization will have, every leader even have different ways of building trust. So some talks about being transparent. Some talk about feeling that I have your back. Some talk about assuming best intent. Some talk about developing a shared knowledge. Some talk about having a cohesive understanding of what makes you successful. So there's a lot of science and research about how do you build trust in a remote environment, and every company can adapt that to their needs. So we talked about three things, right? We talked about how do you work together, the tools and the rules to be intentional about. We talked about being clear about the goals and the expectation, and we talked about intentionally building trust. And the last but not least is to be clear about your mission, why you're here, and to engage people in the business beyond just about making money. It's about having a just cause that enable you to rally people around your business and make sure that you give people a meaning of why they're here. In our case, we are a benefit corporation. We put the mission at the center of everything we do. We connect our business with our mission impact. So these are the four things that leaders can do to drive their business to be successful in a distributed way. And by the way, these are the four things that makes any business successful. I mean, think about being intentional in building trust, right? Maybe in an office, you can get away without being intentional in building trust. But when the remote environment, you have to be intentional to build trust. And then boom, you gain a much better culture. Think about being clear about goals and expectation. Like any great business need to be clear about goals and expectation. Any great business need to be clear about how they work together and being mission driven. So moving to adopting intentionally remote work enables you to be a better business. And that's why distributed companies are going to be the better companies of tomorrow.
Yeah, Thank you for that. I see all your points about being intentional when it comes to business interactions. But my question, you know, looking at the situation from the other point of view, from someone who might be opposing to the fully remote type of organization, is that's okay, but you're still missing the face-to-face interaction. And this is when not having just business conversation necessarily, but more of a personal rapport building, this is when you can cultivate the type of trust that then will drip into any business-like conversation. So do you see that as a challenge? And if so, how do you mitigate that?
Well, thank you for raising that question, Antonietta. Actually, any change doesn't come without challenges, right? So we have to address the challenges that comes with this positive move to move the world into a better future of work. And one of them is this lack of in-person interaction. And in my opinion, and we prove that at Oyster, is you need to have a minimum level of in-person face-to-face interaction to feel the trust that you've built virtually, right? So I remember the first time we met in my team was in November 2 years ago. You know, we built like a $1 billion business without meeting in person, and suddenly now the world is open and we were able to meet. And my VP product came to me. She said to me that she knew that she could trust this team before. Now she can feel she can trust this team. So it's different between knowing and feeling the trust. Why? Because when you're in person, you have all these emotional signaling that comes through our bodies that we don't get through the screen as fluidly as we get in person. To give you an example of that, like when I used to do these talks in front of audiences in real life, I would have fear, as if, you know, somebody from the audience is a lion is going to jump at me and eat me. And I had these like flight and flight responses that are totally human. You know, everybody has that. But now when I do them on Zoom, I don't have that fear anymore. It disappeared because I'm not getting these emotional signaling from the audience. You know, you're not going to jump from my screen and eat me here. I'm safe. So, this proves that in-person meetings are important, and you know, every business has to decide, you know, how frequent they want to do them. At Oyster, we are, especially in this moment, we are much more cost conscious than before. So we're trying to minimize these travels, and but we want to meet at least 2 times a year, and we want to make sure they are programmed. We know when we're going to meet. We look forward to that meeting, that removes anxiety and uncertainty around when you want to meet. Yeah, but I also want to mention that you don't have to meet in person to create a belonging culture, because we have reports, people at Oyster, they say that they feel that they belong to this workplace as virtual much more than they felt belonging to any physical workplace before. And the reason why is because they feel safe to be themselves. It's really this creation of a highly safe, emotionally safe environment that makes people feel that they belong to this place. And that's like, whether you're in the office or you're virtual, you can really make mistakes in that. And it depends a lot on the leader's reactions, starting from the CEO of the company to the executive team. Like, how do you behave when people comes up with bad news, for instance? How do you react to that? Like, do you start blaming people? Do you start reacting, or do you take a step back and take into consideration the human element and people's feelings as you make these business decisions, right? So this is what for us, creating psychological safety is, and it's just amazing to see that people from 100 different nationalities that work at Oyster, that they feel they belong here in this virtual workplace in 80 countries more than any other job they had in person in their local country.
Tony, by the way, we're fully behind you, but just it's interesting when you're contrarian questions, because, you know, it makes you get incredibly specific about the topic. So just to, in this section of the show, I suppose be slightly still contrarian, because there is a large part of both sides of the argument. Have you read about the Blue Zone phenomena?
Yes.
Awesome. So just
got obsessed about it a few years ago.
Yeah, me too. Just for anyone in the audience.
That's why I moved to Cyprus.
Really?
Mediterranean island, because I mean not the only reason, but essentially, you know, like some of these places are Mediterranean islands, right? Where lifestyle is positive for people. Yeah.
So that's amazing. I mean, we'll have to go into that another time. We've got many shows in us, I'm sure. That Blue Zone is really talking about, and just in real brief, having found communities around the globe where, in essence, the life expectancy is the highest that you might find. And therefore, some research was carried out on, well, if these are different cultures in very different areas, clearly there's going to be massive different dynamics. But what might be the trends that run through them? This is very interesting to search in for Mana. So we've talked about this many times on the show. And, you know, some of the things there are what perhaps you and we are thinking about makes good cultures in organizations generally, and therefore in business as well. And so a few of those are what you talked about at the beginning of the show, actually, that you really wanted once you decided, I have financial freedom, so why would I work? And this is why I'm going to work. But here are the parameters. And more we see in the world, hopefully, everybody being able to choose that they want to have, you know, a really healthy diet. You know, they want to have exercise. They want to have outdoor experiences. But in the people element of the Blue Zone, it was about the connection that people have in their community, where if, let's say, there was a question, there would always be a group of individuals in that, let's think of it as some type of village, that you could go to, and they would be the generation above or above who would be able to say, well, look, this is what I did. And that, from what could be screened, reduced stress and anxiety. It allowed people to understand, this is what someone else has done, so I'm not here on my own. And I'm really bullish about that happening in the type of environment that you've created. But to be contrarian, still on this point, you did say the difference between knowing and feel. And I think, to go back to Sam Altman here, what you are taking when you're creating new organizations who have risk in them is potentially really important to have that feeling of trust. Now, you have an organization, and I'm just going off of some of what I know, don't take me verbatim here, that has become very successful very quickly, raised a lot of money. You're a founder who is a serial founder and successful. I think it is a organization that's able to allow people to trust it due to your leadership, the mission, and quite frankly, probably good financial dynamics around it. And you see this in unicorn world a couple of years ago. You know, companies like Monzo were able to create these environments and these cultures where you could be quite philosophical about a Blue Zone type of environment and really focus on the well-being of the individuals in it. And that's wonderful to see. But as we know, with market conditions, and if we look at financial organizations, organizations who have to go to their stakeholders and say, this is our returns, suddenly that can change. And so what I'd love you to talk about is, this is great that you've achieved this as Oyster, And I'm confident you're the guy who's going to carry on achieving this in Oyster. I think you'll find organizations out there in the ether who are in unique scenarios where they can use your platform and create a wonderful remote environment. But for your mission and for our hope, we want this to spread across organizations, across all industry sectors for individuals, because we think that's the big picture. What's the challenges there? How can that happen? And if that can happen, that's going to be one of the biggest dynamic shifts ever. But I'd love you to talk to the challenge there, Tony.
Look, Lloyd, I think there's no version of the future that I see where we're not going to move towards a more human-centric world of work. You know, even with modern innovations such as artificial intelligence, this is all about supporting humans to be better humans. And it's about like these organizations that are still putting the financial results of the organization ahead of its human centricity and making these two to be opposite each other instead of being synergetic together, are the past, are dinosaurs today, right? They're not the future. The future organizations are the ones that are innovating with new modern ways of building organizations, and whether it's, you know, remote work, whether it is leveraging AI for better productivity and collaboration, whether it is using the latest research around what it means to be engaged, what does it mean to have high productivity, what it means to, like, instead of based on opinions of leaders that find it maybe difficult to work.
But Tony, if we look at our role models, and I try and use some out of finance, and whether they're role models or not, if we look at our prominent on the cutting edge individuals, we have Elon Musk very famously dragging his individuals into organizations, showing individuals that he's sleeping on the factory floor, you know, using industrial methods. We have, what else is a good example? We have Twitter connected to him, where somebody who is very liberal, like Jack, went out of the business. And what's been uncovered is that the financial dynamics in that organization weren't great. The shareholders had become unengaged. And you again have Elon Musk coming in using old school dynamics to try and make this organization, yes, profitable and successful, but on the same beneficial to society for freedom of speech, if this is what we were to believe from the narrative. That's just one example of, if I was a 23-year-old who would completely vibe what you're saying and say, I absolutely want to live in a blue zone area. Like, I love hanging out with my friends. I'm super smart. Tooling is getting good. We'll get in the last part of the show onto how tooling needs to improve, which I think it does. I know you'll be invested into that. Don't you think, okay, I'm a caliber A-driven individual. Well, I might go and choose to go do this for the next 10 years because then I'm going to be successful in my career, not just for finance, but because I do want to be successful.
That's a problem. The problem is, what is success? You know, like, is success to be massively successful hedge fund manager in one of the top financial organizations, make tons of money, and then have a very poor relationship with your loved ones, and then maybe pass away at 65 with a heart attack? Or is it to live in Sardinia, which is one of the blue zones, till 110 and see like 2, 3, 4 generations of, and be super connected to your community and support your group? Like, what is success? Like, I don't know. That's the question, right? I'm not saying this is A or B, but it is confusing to know what is success in today's world. And because we are, we created a system that has a specific view of what success is, which is maximizing a number, which is wealth, profit, is very, it reduces massively this complex question to a number. And that's danger. That's dangerous to do that, because then suddenly it's easy to explain what success is. It's your market cap or your stock price performance or how much dividend do you be able to pay shareholders. And well, that's, you know, practical, to simplify what success in business is to a number, it's actually, it misses completely the picture of why we do business, right? What makes me very fulfilled as a leader is to see my team growing, right? Is to see the people that I work with on a day-to-day basis come together to build something very meaningful and everybody feel proud of and progress humanity further. Like that's kind of what this is maybe as important, if not more important than financial success for mission-driven businesses. And that being said, we live in a real world where companies need to work within a framework of financial framework, right? So we're still working in the system. So you need to make sure that you build a business that is a strong business, that is attractive for investors, that is healthy, that is generating profit, that is so you want to find this balance between the two, and it's not easy because it varies a lot by the phase we're going through. And now we're going through a macroeconomical crisis where money has dried up for technology companies, for instance. Like how do you keep being human centric?
I think this is the tipping point. Yeah. I think that if the inspiring characters and organizations can come out of this next phase, which in turbulent markets often is when they can, because there is the ability to disrupt. And we've had many years of this, from COVID enabling remote work to then now, as we were saying, some of the culture coming back in from leaders who knew that that was the culture that worked for them to be successful, to this tipping point. If now you're that 23-year-old or whoever it is that, you know, looking for where are the best experiences for me, and some of these companies are distributed, then there is at least at the bare minimum going to be a few lanes to choose from, and everybody has different versions of success. So certainly my hope is, you know, I mean, if this happened just in all companies, fantastic, but for people to have the ability to choose what type of environments they go into, and therefore them to be able to be successful in either versions of those. And I hope that perhaps with some of the technology we have around blockchain and what we're seeing with DAOs, where there's decentralized organizations, they have huge treasuries. These organizations are setting up just like you did and sat on billions and billions of pounds of treasury with incredible opportunity. And everybody is just, you know, all around the globe. And it's just this wonderful thing to see. And I suspect that will start driving where a lot of the talent goes. So you said, Tony, to move on to the part around tooling, just now talking about
just before moving to tooling, I just want to add something, is that adopting remote work is actually cheaper for business, right? So not only you don't have to pay rent, right? We before the pandemic, in my previous company, we paid $20 million for a lease of 5 years for our office in central London, and then only 10% of people wanted to go back to the office right after the pandemic. Like shit. So first, remote work is cheaper for businesses. You don't have to invest in real estate, and secondly, it is cheaper from a headcount standpoint, because if you tap into the global talent pool, you can access more cost-effective costs for talent around the world, even though you can pay them more and change their life in the local markets. So that's number one, remote work is cheaper. And secondly, building a human-centric culture is free. Like it doesn't cost you more as a leader to create safety, emotional safety in the organization, right? That's free. You don't have to invest money to be a leader that doesn't react negatively to bad news. This is free, right?
You know, sorry, Antek, I'm hogging a few of the questions here, my last for a bit. Is this, Tony, what I've been trying to rack my brain for 20 years about this, and I have no solution, I don't know if there will be one. Is this could be the answer to Beirut and Lebanon's issues? Because all of the great talent, and there is great talent everywhere, there's particularly some fantastic universities in Beirut, leaves Lebanon because of the economic and political issues that are there. And do you think, what's the solution at some point for a place like this? Is this the solution? Because it's a beautiful place. You know, like it's blessed in terms of landscape, food's amazing. The culture, whenever I go there, I went there quite recently, there's lots of issues, but it's got its fantastic warmth, and there is an entrepreneurial spirit that runs through that place. Is this the solution?
It is the solution for Lebanon crisis, but also many, many other, most emerging economies are led by incapable, corrupt governments. I mean, that's just to say it bluntly, right? That has no incentive in transforming their economies, and they also have this problem that the best talent leaves their home country because there's not enough economical opportunities for them. You know, the best doctors in Nigeria go to work in London, right? The best engineers in India go to the US, and so on and so forth. So when you lose your best talent as a nation, well, this is you lost your economical growth potential.
This is getting to now. Well, I'm glad we've got into this level of depth. This is getting to now why I think that Silicon Valley pulls everybody back, because it's worked for Silicon Valley, because there are migrants from all over the world who, if high on their register is, I want to be entrepreneurial, I want to be successful, you go to that physical place. And by the way, this is fantastic that this happened and still does in clusters, and you're probably much more likely to be successful. But that is very restrictive to a whole planet of other equally bright and ambitious individuals. And so there's this move of taking Silicon Valley out and spreading it out now, and it can be much bigger.
And now again, Antonietta, go for it.
Yeah, sorry. I was reading a bit of statistics about Italy, my home country, a few days ago. Elon Musk is worried sick about Italy because he's aging really fast because of this problem where talent and young people graduate from university and then move abroad in the hope to find a better job. And what's happening is that the population is growing older and older. And so this model is not sustainable moving forward. And then it's a beautiful country, but you have those issues in terms of infrastructure, tax regime, which again, I would like to cover at some point later during the show with, you know, policies and regulations and how to support this model, but you know, it's for another time. But this model here could probably support the growth in those countries that are not underdeveloped. They are among the biggest economies, but are struggling in a way.
When the pandemic happened, our business surged, and the major use case was, we called employee diaspora. These were Italian and Spanish and French people that used to work, let's say, in London, realized that actually there's no point of being in London, and they went back home. They went back home to their villages in Italy and in France, and then they never came back to London. They never came back to London. London is the second biggest French city, right? After Paris, there's like 200,000 French people work and live in London, you know?
They've moved from exactly where I am. I'm in Highbury in Islington, and that's where every Italian and French person goes.
Yes.
But I've still fortunately got some of the people who are working in the delis and patisseries here. But I'm in a dramatic exodus of those countries, and understandably so, right? Like, they're beautiful places to be, slightly more affordable. And if you can still get the same opportunity, what a place to, you know, have your family. So it's fantastic that those opportunities exist. And, you know, I'm trying to find where's going to be the blue zone that I take myself to soon as well, because for the Mana Group, you know, we're a remote organization, and very similar to what you're saying, Tony, we had a large office in the city of London, and these things are expensive, sure. But also, actually, we couldn't run our organization as well with part of the organization coming into that HQ and then some part of the organization distributed, because then you had this uneven keel of the culture. So because we were really trying to go down the hybrid route, and then at some point we thought, do you know what? This works better for us as an organization to fully commit to remote. And I mean, Anto, since we've done that, it's been such a pleasure compared to trying to run that hybrid scenario.
Yeah, I agree. It levels the field for everyone to have the same starting point and to give the best
Yeah, and we did the same or similar thing, Tony, where, you know, when we can, we'd bring people to a kind of workshop together and, you know, do things like walk around the park and, you know, spend some time with each other. But we don't do it that frequently. We're not the scale of organization that you are. But certainly for us, it has been a really fantastically liberating thing to do. So you can see the benefits. Moving on to the section and the concluding section where we're going to go into some of the tooling with Tony. Anto, if you could fire away, please.
Yeah, for sure. Of course, Tony, 2023 has been one of the major topics that have been covered during this 2023 is AI and its impact on businesses, on the way people live, work, learn, all that can come with that. So what is, in your view, the relationship between AI, the progress that we're making with technology, and also the future of work? How is that going to impact?
It is absolutely linked to the future of work. I believe AI is going to accelerate us into a future of work that is very different than when we used to now. Obviously, I just want to start by acknowledging the fears, totally relevant fears that we all have from this technology. We don't know how far we can go with it. We don't know what's going to be its negative impact on our lives and on our work. That being said, there's no doubt in my head that's going to be a massive implication on how we work and how we live. I believe this technology elevates the human potential and enable us to be much more effective and productive, especially in a remote work environment. This is where it connects with the future of work, in a sense that by having this technology at your fingertips, you can be a much better communicator when you communicate through words, which is most of the work that asynchronous collaboration entails. It's really about communicating through words, written words, by elevating your capabilities, your linguistic capabilities, with the help of generative AIs, you transform your productivity. Just to give you an example, research have shown there is 20% increase in productivity for customer support agents holding tickets when they use AI, and they can increase that by reduce their time to response and increase the quality of their work. Because they can appear more empathic to the customer, for instance, and resolve things much faster. At Oyster, I have told the company that we need to have everybody in the company to be AI literate, because as a human-centric organization, we want to make sure that people are equipped with the latest technologies, because the moment they leave Oyster, the chances that the next job will require them to use AI is like nearly 100%, especially knowledge workers. I mean, knowledge workers, for me, the probability that they need to use AI in their work is pretty much 100% in their jobs. On the personal level, like, I think AI is a very creative technology. Like, for me, I use it every day to increase my level of creativity. Like, I create content, I get support from it. There's use cases. I have use cases of building on my AI therapist with it, right? So it's supporting me emotionally. I've written a nanny playbook. We just hired a new nanny, and if I didn't have this technology, I would not be able to be effective in managing the new nanny. Now she has 18 chapters that were written in, you know, like, so she has a handbook for a nanny. I would have never imagined me able to do this in my own voice. Now it's possible to do it, and it's all to iterate on it. So I've written songs, poems, jokes. I mean, like, it's such a creative technology. It should. It feels that this technology has been, I've been waiting for all my life.
I got to say, I didn't think of the playbook application for the nanny, but I'm going to steal that for sure, because I'm leaving sticky notes everywhere. So
exactly.
It's kind of old fashioned. For sure, this is improving in a way creativity. So you have two side points where you have someone who fears, obviously, that, you know, AI will take away from humanity. But I find fascinating your relationship with it in a way where you describe Oyster as a tech platform, but with a strong human element. So if you could give us a bit more on that. Do you already use AI in your company? Are you planning to do so? Do you have a roadmap for that? And what is the expectation when it comes to tooling and systems? So that, you know, give us a bit of background, if you can, on how a client comes to you and you help them making their life easier, and if and when you're going to use AI to that end.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, AI is impacting our category and our industry massively, because a lot of the value we provide to our customers around knowledge and insight of employment laws, compliance regulation around the world, tax laws, country by country. And the challenge with current generative AI models is that they're not accurate, and they depend a lot on the data set that they have access to. So what we're doing is we're implementing these generative AI conversational technology on our own data sets. We're training them on our own knowledge and insight about global employment, and therefore supporting the customer through their journey in a much more accurate, faster way. So essentially, it's a technology that's going to dramatically create a magical customer experience, while keeping the human element, because the customer don't necessarily want to talk to us for low value transactions, such as, I don't know, help me understand how much time off I should give my employee in France to be competitive. That question is answered by our platform and AI. However, if they have a sensitive question about, you know, I have a performance issue with this person in that country, I want to have a conversation with an HR person to understand how can navigate this delicate matter in a human-centric way, then boom, you have a human person helping you with that. So essentially, it helped us to push the boundaries of value creation for the customer. Well, repetitive tasks can be more scaled with the use of AI conversational technologies, but it requires accuracy, and that's where implementing it on our own data model and training it on our data model give us the opportunity to be 100% accurate, because we guarantee the compliance for the customer.
Yeah.
I was recently kind of putting engineering prompts into one of the main tools, and then comparing it with one of the more recent tools to have come out. And particularly interesting what you're talking about there, because I was asking it to make the type of prediction where I might use somebody like a lawyer. So you can read law and almost come out of it with a risk tolerance to never do anything. And so when you, I find, are working with a lawyer, I think a lot of the human element there is, well, you want them to have that resource, of course, but you're typically saying to them, here's my risk appetite. What are the likely consequences that are both positive / downside if I were to take this move? And you'll rarely ever get a lawyer who says it's a 10 or it's a 1. It's okay, well, you know, it's 7. No, that's not good enough. Like, is this 8 or is this 6? And so I was trying to see how the tools would give me a risk tolerance. And today they're very cautious, I tend to find. And so I really like prompted it. So the example, so the example was, I'm having a lot of conversations with people around whether artificial intelligence will positively or negatively disrupt employment in the workplace moving forward. Rate to me out of 10, your prediction that is true or not. To start with,
no, I couldn't do that, but perhaps read around this. And I was like, no, I want you to specifically give me, and once you start doing that, it'll come back with numbers. And it rated very highly that it's going to disrupt most roles today. But of course, as you just said, with the caveat of, you know, if done properly, if using the right data sets, it can be such a fantastic thing that we do that. And if we look at trends over the last 10 years, over the last 50, over the last 100, when there is displacement, typically new roles are created and better opportunities can come out of it. So you're thinking about this, as Anto's kind of probed into so interestingly with your platform. You know, if you could, you've explained to us right now how you are looking at it and using it, and it's prudent for everybody to get competent with it. What's a really exciting scenario for you with the Oyster platform if you took it down the path and thought about how AI could be optimized?
Yeah, I do have an exciting vision for that. I want in the next few years to have our R&D team, instead of building codes and building application ourselves, and is really about managing the AI system that we've built that is specifically customized for our own business, our own category, our own markets. And I can envision that this AI technology that is custom for our business to be self-developing and self-healing, where essentially there's a new regulation that happened in that country, to go take that regulation, make a decision, what form should I update in the platform? Should I go back and change these contracts, send the customer communication, get them to sign automatically? So I do see businesses that are driven by knowledge and insights, such as our business and software, to be transformed by artificial intelligence and have a... But I also believe that it's not going to happen. You don't have to build it from scratch, you know, every time for your business. I think you're gonna see an explosion of AI applications, like AI app stores. Let's say I'm working with our chief of staff on an application where we create a module, AI module, that analyze the competition and how we position in that, and give us recommendation, strategic recommendation of what we should do. Well, we're building that module, but that module can be used by anybody, right? So we can release that application back into the world, and then people can download that application and use it. Think about it as a Salesforce app exchange, but for AI application. I think that's where the new modern ERP system will be there, right?
So I think that that's an amazing thing. I'd love you to share that with us. I think just to finish on that point, this debate about positive and negative, like the way that you're looking at it is so positive. And to finish on that example of, let's use something closer than lawyer to maybe the world we're in. You know, we're in the world of hiring and headhunting, and you have huge teams within organizations in talent acquisition functions. Well, is this going to be good or is this going to be bad for those individuals? I think that we could make the case of, it can take away a lot of the administrative and arduous work that you have to do today, or you had to do a couple of years ago. And it can put you into the position where you're so well-tooled to do the things that are human, which are so crucial in all, but particularly this function too. If you could talk to that as well, I'd be really fascinated on how you see talent acquisition functions benefiting from this move.
Yeah, it's going to increase the value impact that recruiters will have. You know, your value is to is a human touch, right? Is how do you sense the person, the chemistry, connect the fit of that person with the company culture you're hiring for. All these things are hard to do by a statistical model. However, everything else can be done by statistical model. You know, building the pipeline, finding the right candidates, develop three profiles and go after them. Maybe outreach technology, you know, creating all this content to engage the employee and get them to talk to you. You know, all these things that are admin intensive and actually it's hard to be good in them if you're not like the best, most experienced recruiter. So you take a junior recruiter and you give them that technology, then suddenly they are acting like an experienced 20 years experienced recruiter, right? Because all this secret sauce around building the pipeline and rating people and but then suddenly their potential is elevated because they're focused on the human conversation and the assessment of the chemistry. It's really hard to assess through a statistical model.
I agree to a level. Talent acquisition, finding the right talent for the right position is something that is really close to our heart. This is where we come from. This is what we call the core business. But as you said, for your for your own company, your own platform, there is a tech element and then there is the human element. So I agree with you. Tooling up a talent acquisition team is going to put them in the best position to do their job and to complete most tasks that otherwise they would need to externalize. So that's a win for sure. There is another benefit that I see, and is taking away the biases. So it's probably easier to have a more equal, diverse environment, but then there is always that human element of the experience that you had on the field year after year, and to gain that thing that tells you in your spine whether a candidate is the right one or not, whether the motives are there, the language that they're using, the, you know, the body language even, that it's sort of something that I think that no technology can replace anytime soon. But that's, you know, that's my feeling.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely a part of the value chain that will be not replaceable by machines. And I think many of the low-level tasks will be, and it will be done so much better than humans, because it's
a good thing. It's a good thing that we aren't replaceable after all.
You're not.
But it's going to have an impact in terms of equality, diversity, you know, starting up how you want your team to be composed at the very end of the process. That is for sure.
You mean, can you elaborate on that? Like, you mean the AI can help you?
The AI, I believe, can help with that. So
If
you decide that your team is going to be diverse to start with, you want to achieve that target, and you get the machine achieving that target or at least guiding the process, then you, in a way, eliminate those biases where one person will tend to select what they know and what they're familiar with. And so they go in the opposite direction of diversity, because what is different from what we know can be scary for a human being. So we tend to reiterate what we already know, but AI shouldn't. So what do you see? Do you agree with that, or do you see it differently?
Yep. Yeah, I agree. I agree with that potential. Mm.
Tony.
Lovely.
I think we've covered all of the topics, and thank you so much for your time. Really just to end with, and you've given us the view of this in many different ways, but let's give you the platform for this brilliant mission to just conclude talking to our audience about, you know, the big Hollywood vision for Oyster in the future of work, please.
Yeah, I think it's less about the vision of Oyster, but the vision of the future of work, right? What we envision is that the future work will become more flexible and more free to decide where you want to live and when you want to work. We want the future to also look more equal and more diverse. We want more organizations to look like Oyster. There's plenty level diversity. We are in 80 countries, 100 plus nationalities, people from all over the world coming to build this business. We want to see this adoption of remote work at scale enable more access to opportunities for people around the world, especially in emerging markets. not because you're in Morocco that you shouldn't deserve the opportunity of the same person in central London. Right? And what I hope is that more and more entrepreneurs take into consideration their mission impact, how they build businesses, embedding the mission into your core, the core of your business is demonstrated to be better for business. It enhances your chances of success. At Oyster, 58% of customers that choose us mention the mission as one of their criteria. So that's important to drive the world into a more sustainable future.
Well, it's incredibly inspiring. And I do think in the future work, you know, we're excited to be doing this show right now with entrepreneurs like you, because it's a moment in time where it feels like it's got prominence and it is changing people's everyday opportunities in life. So I'm certainly so inspired by the message that you've given, the businesses that you've built, and you know, we will stay very close to watching how Oyster carries on, hopefully successfully carrying out its mission. Thank you so much for coming on the Future of Work show.
Thank you, Tony.
You for having me.
Thank you for joining us on this episode of the Future of Work podcast. We hope you've enjoyed it. Please leave a like and a review and subscribe to our iTunes channel to stay up to date with the newest content. Find us on social media at Searching for Mana. Tell us who you want next on the show. Thanks again and see you next time.